For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and coming up today, Lexi Elliott will tell me how to kill your best friend. We'll go back in time to find out about Elsewhere at the Edinburgh International Book Festival. And the golden voice of Juliet Stevenson will tell us about narrating for RNIB. All that and more on today's Read On. Lexi Elliott, author of The French Girl and The Missing Years, joined me down the line to talk about how to kill your best friend. Georgie, Lissa and Bronwyn have been friends since they met on their college swimming team. Now Lissa is dead, drowned off the coast of the remote island where her second husband owns a luxury resort. But could a star open water swimmer really have drowned, or is something more sinister going on? We'll hear from Lexi in a moment, but for now let's hear from the audio version read by both Melanie Crawley and Sarah Cullum.
Adam was asking the other day about how we met, I say. Georgie doesn't answer, but I'm fairly sure she's paying close attention. Sometimes I forget he wasn't at uni with the rest of us. Us, meaning Georgie, Duncan, myself, and Lissa. And Graham, once upon a time. 5, then 4, now 3. Anyway, what was it, 16, 17 years ago that we met? Something like that. I've known you as long as I haven't. A short laugh bursts out of me unexpectedly, and she arches her neck slightly and smiles, enjoying my reaction. How typically Georgie. The sly twist she puts on things that halts you in your tracks. She never quite says what everyone else would, but she almost does. If you weren't paying attention, you'd miss the difference. Ah, I say wryly. But I'm WYSIWYG, remember? WYSIWYG. What you see is what you get. That's what Lissa used to describe me as. It was affectionately meant, and I took it as such, even if I sometimes wished to be just a little mysterious. Though only a little, mystery must be so exhausting.
The book is called How to Kill Your Best Friend. It is a psychological thriller which is set on a remote island in Southeast Asia where a group of friends come together to commemorate the loss of one of their number who drowned while swimming off the coast of that island. And whilst they're there, the group of friends all start to question what really might have happened to Lissa, the woman who drowned. We see the story through the eyes of Georgie and Bronwyn, and this group of friends have been brought together at university through a love of swimming. They're all part of the college swimming team. So it does seem a little strange that Lissa might have drowned despite being a star swimmer. And as the weather turns ominous, essentially trapping them there, they all start to question each other and what might truly have happened. And it begins to dawn on them that perhaps Lissa's death is just the beginning.
Lissa is dead. She's dead. She's dead. She's dead. How can she be dead? It's been a constant tattoo in my brain over these past 3 months. Since Bron called to tell me, though she couldn't get the words out, Duncan had to take the phone off her. "There's been an accident," he said. His voice was raw but steady. "She went for a swim the other night by herself at Canoe Cove and..."
"Wait, she? Who? Who went?"
"Lissa."
"Lissa? But..."
"She's missing, Georgie. Lissa is missing. She didn't come back. They're still searching, but by now there's really no hope," he said. "And the water at Canoe, you haven't seen it, but Christ, I don't know what she could have been thinking. The police will record it as missing, presumed." "No." I wouldn't let him say it. "I don't believe it." I didn't believe it then, and I don't know how to believe it now.
Now, what inspired that setting?
To be honest, on this book, which is a little unusual for me, the first thing that came to me was the title. And I'd gone on holiday to an island in Southeast Asia. This will all come together in a moment. And my publisher had asked, well, what are you going to write next? And so I was thinking of different things whilst I was away on holiday. And that title came to me. And I thought, that is a really intriguing title. You know, why would anyone want to kill their best friend? What must have happened? What's in the history of these friends? Who are these friends? And all those questions kind of opened up. And I think I was hugely influenced by where I was. And I'd begun to have an inkling that this cast of characters was going to be drawn together by swimming and there was going to be a drowning. And it really started to make sense to set it pretty much exactly where I was. Although the nice thing about not naming a place is that you can really mess with the geography of it and put in what you need to fit the plot without upsetting somebody who might otherwise say, well, no, it doesn't look like that, or that's over there instead. And I don't have to worry about that if I never name it and keep it fictional.
Are you an Agatha Christie fan? Being trapped on an island is very Christie-like.
Yeah, I did read a lot of Agatha Christie in my teenage years, I suppose, to the point where I feel like they slightly merged in my head and I can never quite remember which one was which. I probably ought to go back and read the whole canon again, because she really was the master of that. And, you know, the isolating a group of people in a sort of locked door situation and so on, locked room perhaps is a better word. Yeah, she absolutely knew how to do that to full effect. But you're not the first person to mention that. I consider it a great compliment.
Now, talking of How to Kill Your Best Friend, was it fun to write the method sections?
They were the most fun to write. And actually, my kids got really involved. It became this kind of post-school conversation. Instead of saying, you know, do you have any homework? They'd come back and say, never mind the homework. I've got a new idea on how you might kill someone.
How to Kill Your Best Friend. Method 1. Accident. Yes, but what kind of accident? It's so easy in the movies. A pleasant walk along the cliff top, then, bam, a sudden shove. In real life, there's no handily accessible cliff, and if there was, nobody in their right mind would walk so close to the edge of it. And supposing, just supposing, those two obstacles were somehow resolved, there's always the chance that somebody would see you. A dog walker, probably. There's always a bloody dog walker around. It's just like they say. It's not the murder that's the problem, it's the getting away with it. No, wait, the murder is a problem too.
And I did at one point think, oh my God, if anybody actually goes through my search history on my internet, I will look like the dodgiest person in the planet.
What was your favourite?
There's a little discussion on electrocution, which I did research quite heavily, and which I find quite entertaining and, in fact, informative. So there you go.
Now, what was it like writing from two different points of view, having two main narrators?
I hadn't done that before. And when I was first kind of getting going with this novel, I was trying to find my way into it. And I felt that that was what was needed. And I was a little scared of it, but I think that's a good thing, because then it means, you know, you're challenging yourself, and then that keeps the writing fresh and the process kind of more interesting for you as a writer, and therefore I think more interesting for the reader. I found that I got to know Georgie and Broman so very well that it was easy to speak in each of their voices. And they're very, very different characters. Their lives are very different when we meet them, despite obviously having been very similar at a certain point at university. You know, Georgie is in Manhattan, single, career girl, you know, it looks like she's living a very glamorous life, whereas Bronwyn is, she's recently given up her job and she's a stay-at-home mum in a London suburb. And, you know, grappling with, you know, whether that was the right thing to do and whether she really actually should have continued with job and so on. They're at very different places in their life.
Was it easy to switch between them when you were writing?
Yeah, it was quite easy. I think once you know them and you feel like they're living inside your head and they are living, breathing people inside your head, which is what happens for me. My characters sort of start to build themselves up and then they And then once they do, they will take a turn every once in a while in a different direction to what you'd envisaged. And I always get quite excited when that happens because I feel like, okay, they are real, fully fledged human beings with their own ideas, and I should go with that.
You don't need long to get to know me. I don't know. You still manage to surprise me from time to time. She's still smiling, still pulling me into the bright circle of Georgie. She could be the exact same girl, not a cell different from the one I met 17 or so years ago.
So as you say, the book is written from the point of view of two different people. So the audiobook has two narrators, Sarah Cullum and Melanie Crawley. What did you think of the audio version?
I think it's great. I think they really did get fantastic people for this. And I was involved in their selection. And yeah, I'm really thrilled with the product. I usually get given, you know, a number of people to choose from, but it really just leapt out at me that these were the right people. And particularly with their ability to sort of get the humor. I know it's a psychological thriller and I know it can be a little dark in places, but the book has humor within it. And occasionally I've found that readers, particularly if they're not British, might not pick up on that. But, you know, this has been done very well.
Do you not fancy doing it yourself?
I did have a conversation about that at one point. And at the end of the day, I don't think I have the range to do lots of different voices, so certainly that would be inhibiting with, you know, a dual narrative, and then the other thing is it takes a really long time and maybe I ought to be using that time to write some other books rather than read out my own material. But I've done some reading of my own material for various podcasts and things, and I think I do okay. I just think that the acting part of it, where, you know, you have somebody different speaking and you would be better to adopt a different voice, I think I might fall down at that point.
If you had a choice, if you were one of the narrators in this book, who would you be, Georgie or Bronwyn?
I think I'd probably be Georgie. That's a very insightful question. Well done, you.
Now, this is coming on the back of The French Girl and The Missing Years. Are you working on another psychological thriller or are you looking at other genres?
So I have just finished another psychological thriller, which ought to be out in the early part of next year. We're just going through the last copy edit and then there'll be the proof. But we're pretty much there. And that's going to be called Bright and Deadly Things. And then I have been working on the side on something in a completely different genre, which I'm not contracted on. It's just been something that I've been working on in my spare time. So I don't know quite whether I will get a contract on that and whether I'll do it alongside the next psychological thriller. We will have to see. But I dare say that would have to go out under a slightly different name because, you know, a Lexie Elliott reader expects a psychological thriller.
Heroes and villains, I think, are heroes and villains, depending on where you're looking at them from. But how do you write the perfect villain?
Well, I'm with you that actually nobody really is purely one or the other. I mean, maybe there are some people in the world who are pure evil. Maybe there are some who are just, you know, purely angelic. But, you know, there can't be many. Most people are a mixture of both. And one poor choice can tip them over into something, you know, that's a little more nefarious. And so I think to write a really good villain, you need to make them real such that the readers will relate to them. They'll understand how they get to the point they get to. And although they would hope that they wouldn't make those choices themselves, they make sense within the context and the framework of that particular character. And that's when I think you've got a compelling villain.
Now, swimming is a big part of the book, and you yourself are a very keen swimmer, even swimming the English Channel.
Yes, that was 2007, which, oh goodness, long time ago now.
And I've heard you talk about some of the lessons you learned by that swim.
One of them is just to kind of keep going. I mean, the most important thing about this is to keep going and don't get disheartened by any obstacles along the way. So, you have to do necessarily a lot of training for swimming the channel. And there were certain swims that I had intended to do that for whatever reason just didn't quite happen. You know, maybe I didn't last the time that I wanted to be in the cold water or whatever it was. And one in particular, I do remember, like a lot of people do what's called a split channel swim before they go out and swim the channel. So they'll swim for maybe 7 hours one day and 6 hours the next day. And I did the first day and I just couldn't get past 3 hours the next day. I think I was unwell or becoming unwell, but I felt so disheartened and so demoralized by that. And I had to really sort of pick myself up and go, okay, you know, that was one particular day. You can't decide that this whole venture is doomed because you have one bad day. Getting across the channel is going to be the combination of a series of training days and then the event itself.
So you take that to your writing as well, even if you're feeling disheartened one day, don't give up, just pick up the manuscript again.
Yeah, that's right. I think there's a lot of parallels, oddly enough, between endurance sports and writing a novel. I mean, to mention the obvious cliche, it's a marathon, not a sprint, on a novel as well. And you do have good days, you do have bad days. You have to find your way to sitting yourself down and getting on with it, even when you don't feel like it, just in the same way that you need to pull on your trainers or pull on your swimsuit or whatever it might be and go and do the training, even if you don't feel like it. And sometimes I do that by saying, you know, if I'm going on a run and I don't feel great, I might say, well, look, I'll only go for 20 minutes. Surely I can do 20 minutes. And then you nearly always end up doing much longer. And the same with writing. It's like, well, if I only get 500 words, well, it's 500 more than I had, but you will end up doing more and then being really pleased with yourself. And if you do find that there's a problem trying to find a different way to attack it. So, you know, for anything which is athletic, that could be that you have an injury and you have to then go and cross train in different ways to keep your fitness going. And on the writing, sometimes I get stuck on a section and I will perhaps jump ahead and write the next section and then come back to it. And sometimes when I come back to it, I think, oh, I could do that differently, or maybe I don't even need it. I can get that information across in a different way. And maybe I was just actually boring myself writing it. And that's why I was getting stuck. And if I'm boring myself, I am sure I will bore a reader. So, you know, there's a lesson in that.
Breakfast. Breakfast on my own, on a terrace overlooking a bay with colours so brightly saturated that it's as if someone has applied an Instagram filter to the whole vista. Breakfast that has been cooked, not poured from a cereal box, by somebody else and delivered by a young man with a smile and skin so perfect it's ludicrous that he isn't starring in a face cream commercial. I would give anything for this normally, so why can't I enjoy it?
How to Kill Your Best Friend by Lexi Elliott is available now, both in print, on ebook, and as an audiobook, narrated by Sarah Cullum and Melanie Crawley. And Lexi, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Lexi will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life. You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. If you're listening to this around the time of broadcast, the Edinburgh International Book Festival 2022 is on now. RNIB won't be there this year, but I thought I'd look back at the archives to some of the past events and came across a feature about a four-book series called Elsewhere. It really is one of those hidden gems in the RNIB Talking Books library. Let's hear about it from some of the authors themselves.
Elsewhere. For me, the word had a magic ring right from the start, like the beginning of a fairy tale. Once upon a time, far, far away, long, long ago, elsewhere.
Elsewhere is a collection of short stories by 50 Scottish writers commissioned by the Edinburgh International Book Festival, where I am right now. Elsewhere is entirely new. Elsewhere is a world we dream of visiting. Elsewhere is all the places we have ever been. Elsewhere is here, there, somewhere, and everywhere. The Elsewhere collection brings together many of the most influential and acclaimed writers in the world today. In the four themed volumes of Here, There, Somewhere and Everywhere, these writers explore what it means to them to be elsewhere. The print collection was first offered for sale at last year's Edinburgh Festival. This year marks the 10th anniversary of RNIB Scotland's association with the festival, and it was the braille and audio version of Elsewhere that RNIB launched at a special event on the first day of the festival. Director of the festival, Nick Barley, told me about the book.
Elsewhere was commissioned in 2009. It was kind of a response to the Year of Homecoming, in which a lot of writers were talking about Scotland and the experience of writing in Scotland and being Scottish. And I wanted something that acknowledged that Scottish writers are not simply great because they write well about Scotland, although they do. Mm. But also that they can write brilliantly about other places too. And so I wanted to make sure that Scottish writing represented a sense of other places as well. And so I hit on the idea of commissioning stories with the subject Elsewhere to see what that might throw up. And of course, I hadn't quite realised that Elsewhere doesn't necessarily have to be a physical elsewhere. Mm. It can be, that elsewhere can mean all sorts of things. It can mean after death. It can mean your mind being elsewhere whilst your body is here.
Mm.
Or elsewhere can really be being here but feeling alienated from here. So of course, writers being brilliant interpreted my commission and came up with the most astonishing array of ideas and stories, which I'm hugely proud to have published it.
Authors at the event included James Robertson, Teresa Breslin, Janice Galloway, Anne Donovan and Anne Fine.
Restless, my mother called me. And maybe she was right, for I am tense by nature, gnawing my fingernails until they bleed. But if it was simple restlessness, then surely I would have taken much better to a married life which led to 2 years here and 1 year there, 6 months in this place, followed by a year in that. After the 7 years so many fairy tales tell us we have to wait for what we want, I jumped ship, wanting to be back where there is frost and fog and gales and snow that comes as a surprise rather than as a settled fact of life.
A clip from Anne Fine's story in Elsewhere, called As the Proverb Goes. I asked Anne about her story.
Oh, I suddenly realised that as I got older and older and older, I've absolutely loathed going anywhere. I mean, I treat my hotel bedrooms as if they were my own bedroom and just sit in the bath for hours. And I no longer rush out and look at ruins or try and catch an art gallery before it closed. So I thought, well, either I'm middle-aged or I've come to some sort of wisdom that everywhere is here and here is everywhere. It sounds very lofty. And now I'm completely relaxed about not going anywhere at all. And all my friends are rushing around on their Jules Verne holidays and fitting in Petra. Next year they're going to go to Costa Rica. And I actually secretly pity them. So I'm a real sad case.
When I was asked to do Elsewhere, a lot of my work, or almost all of it, is set in Glasgow.
And Donovan.
So I decided that a character from my novel, Buddha Da, would be somewhere else, and the story was really about him and his brother and his other pal who run a painting and decorating business going off to work for a short time in Italy, and really what the experience of being in a different place and a different environment, so with a character that I was already familiar with.
The heat whops you the minute you set foot out the plane. The brightness too. Blue sky barely skiffed with cloud. This is a life, says John. Can't you believe this is September? I pull off my jacket. It's like the middle of summer. I thought it'd be like autumn at home. Bright, but with a nip in the air. Hadn't expected this.
My interpretation of Elsewhere was to make it somewhere distinctly different. I love travelling, and I've travelled all over the world, both with work, with stories, with going to book festivals, etc., and just out of interest, researching books.
Teresa Breslin.
So the most unusual place that I'd been to was Uzbekistan, And one of the things that features very prominently there is very active storytelling. At night, people sit on eating platforms and just recount things that have happened during the day and also stories from the past. And there was particular storytellers, and our guide was a good storyteller, and we exchanged stories on this trip. And I thought I could weave this very unusual place, very unusual characters, and have a story within a story. And that would be definitely elsewhere from Scotland and where I live.
When the tour buses halted at the cotton fields beyond Samarkand, it was Rumil who was always first to break off working. Like exotic migrant birds, tourists from Britain, America, Germany, Japan and elsewhere would swoop, flocking and chaffering along the roadside. Often Rumil took the chance to light a cigarette and observe from a distance. No one was interested in him anyway. It was the women they wanted to see. Those who still wore the traditional vibrant Uzbek dress, the dark-eyed young girls. And the older folk, with their array of gold-filled front teeth. Most of the tourists would have read up on the history and culture of Uzbekistan and absorbed the information provided by more diligent tour guides. These foreign visitors didn't consider themselves tourists. In their view, tourists went off to holiday resorts for a fortnight in the sun. They were travellers, he'd heard them say.
Ten years ago, the book launched by RNIB was Clara by Janice Galloway. I asked Janice how that felt.
Well, a huge privilege. I mean, you've had so many intergalactic names since then. It feels that... I'm not sure why you picked me for the first, apart from the fact that that was the same year that book came out, and it was the fattest book I'd written, and it was the first book for a long time, but I'm very pleased, whatever it was. It's important to talk to people, especially when you can't be there in person.
Now, you've also narrated for RNIB, This Is Not About Me. Now, what's it like narrating your own books?
It doesn't feel like your own voice. I mean, I was a teacher for Yonks. Before that, I was a very shy child. People always look at me as though I'm daft when I say I was a very shy child. I was a very shy child. And I met a music teacher who changed my life by teaching me to get up on stage and sing. Mm-hmm. You know, he said, it's not your words, it's okay, you're safe. Nobody's going to attack you for singing somebody else's words. And I got used to the idea of persona. And when you walk onto a stage at an event like this, or when you're reading a book, it's not really you. You're acting to a certain extent. You're doing the voice of your people. You're doing the voice that you think other people will respond to. And then, of course, the final irony on top of that is we never sound like how we think we sound. I don't actually know what I sound like. So these three distances, if you like, keep me away from feeling it's self-exposure. It's a voice, and it's talking directly to the listener, or it's speaking directly to the reader. And I don't really mind what you think about it. That's the whole point, is for you to make up your mind what you think. I don't feel judged by that. I feel that's your right.
We are at the RNIB launch. How important is it that your book's available in Braille and in audio?
I would think it's massively important. At the initial launch, I meant to say when I was on stage today, at the initial launch, there was a man who spoke very movingly. He got up, the dog was at his side, he had a stick, he had all the trappings of I can't see were clearly visible with him. And the first thing he said was, when I hit a certain age, I just lost all my books. I'd been a reader all my life, and I lost all my books. And I thought, jings, you know, this is something that a great many of us never have to think about. What do you do when you lose the books? How do you get them back? If you're lucky enough to have a spouse or a family member or a mate who will read them to you, that's wonderful. But how many of us have that? And how many of us want to spend 6 hours reading War and Peace to us, you know, or 3 weeks or whatever the hell it takes? I imagine it's a massively important thing. And, of course, it's so important to give quality literature, to make quality literature available. But a book that makes a difference to your way of thinking can make a difference to your entire life. And I think it's massively important that RNIB are finally getting the chance to do this up here.
Teresa Breslin.
I think it's absolutely, absolutely crucial. I trained as a librarian. I started off when I was 17 in Glasgow libraries, and that was in Townhead, which was one of the places where they had a Braille section. And I met people there who used a Braille section and chatted to them and actually one of them was teaching me some Braille to read, and it was a lifeline, it was an education, it was fed the imagination. But fiction, I think, is the great gift of humanity, and I think all the books should immediately be available.
Anne Donovan.
Absolutely crucial. It's so important. I mean, everyone should have access to books and be able to hear them or read them in whatever form is best for them, and it is really important. I was quite shocked at the statistic mentioned earlier that only 7% of books published are available to blind and partially sighted people, which is quite shocking, especially since with modern technology and so on. I think that there are many more options for folk, and I'm really hoping that that figure improves, and I'm so impressed with all the things the RNIB has been doing to help that.
And the book Elsewhere is still available from RNIB Talking Books. 50 short stories by Ali Smith, by Marcus Sedgwick, Julia Donaldson, A.L. Kennedy, Alistair Gray, Roddy Doyle, and much, much more. A real hidden gem in the RNIB Talking Books library. Just search for Elsewhere. It's the first result in the RNIB Reading Services website, but it does say the author is anonymous. You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Talking Books. And talking of talking books,
Juliet Stevenson is a star of stage, screen and audio. Her roll call of stage plays and audiobooks includes some of the best-known works in English literature. Not that she's let it go to her head. Despite all these calls on her time, particularly to record commercial audiobooks, she's still a regular at the RNIB Talking Books Studios. And being truly, madly and deeply a fan, I just had to ask her into the studio for a chat. Juliet Stevenson, welcome to Read On.
Thank you.
Can you tell me what you're recording for us at the moment?
Yes, I'm recording a novel by Antonia Byatt, otherwise known as A.S. Byatt, called The Children's Book, which I mistakenly thought was going to be a children's book. And I thought, why is it going to take 9.5 days in a studio? No child would read a book that long. But it turns out that's just the title. It's an adult novel written a few years ago, something like 2009, I think. Huge rambling piece set at the end of the 19th century. Amazing story. But we're only on day two, so, you know, we've got a long way to go.
How much stamina, in comparison to your stage work, does it take to take on a large novel like that?
Well, I really love recording large novels. I just love the whole thing of going into a booth at 9:30 or 10 in the morning and staying there all the working day with this work of literature. It's kind of heaven for me. If the book's good, if it's not a good book, then it's a slightly different story. But most of what I'm really lucky to be asked to do are great books. So it's delicious for me to sit and do that. I mean, yeah, there's a certain point mid-afternoon where your tongue starts to feel like it's 6 foot wide and you can get a bit squinty. But I really do love it. And I love the immersion. I think what I love in all forms of work is just the immersion right down into it. And with a audiobook, that's what you're doing. You're sinking down into this book. You have to play all the characters. You get right inside the story, the novel, the observations, the thinking, the world of the fiction. And I kind of love that about it. And also, I'm not that well read. I didn't go to university and so on. So I'm very grateful to the audiobook world for allowing me, giving me the chance and paying me to read some of the world's great literature.
And do you do huge amounts of preparation, marking up in different coloured pens the different characters?
I don't mark up, partly because I read off a screen these days and I can't be bothered to work those apps which you write on your screen. But yeah, I read ahead. I don't always read the whole novel before I start. I mean, ideally I would, but with huge novels, I don't always have time. So I would always read ahead of where I'm going to record. What I do is I make notes about each character. So I'll write down notes on every single person who speaks, what the author says about them, age, class, where they come from, think about what accent they might have, if any, to do with class and region, the age, obviously, so where you pitch it, and then what kind of rhythm. I'm very preoccupied by rhythms, and everybody has their own. Some people speak very fast, they think fast but speak slowly, or they think slowly and speak fast, or they speak slowly but are very powerful, or, you know, there's loads of things with rhythm that you can do. So those are the sorts of questions I will think about and make notes on. And if, as is the case with this A.S. Byatt book, you've got loads of different characters having conversations between 6, 7, 8 people in one scene, then I might cast it in my head. Because you can't really jump constantly to your notes and be reading notes every time somebody speaks. So if you cast it, so it might be, I think this character sounds like Theresa May, or sounds like David Attenborough, or sounds like the postman who comes around our house. Whoever it is, if you have somebody in your head who you think really sounds like this character, then it's a quick, easy way to jump from one to the other.
That must be where your experience of working in the theatre and working in film must come in invaluable, because you can be a director. You have worked with some amazing directors in your time and you can emulate them.
Yes, it's true. You are self-directing a lot of the time. I mean, you know, you've got a producer or a very skilled engineer, the other side of the glass, who's also got views on this. But I would expect from myself to make most of the decisions, and then they'll let you know if they don't like it. Or the other big consideration, perhaps the most important one for me, is what is the tone of this particular writer's voice? I don't like audiobooks where the reader is getting in the way. I love listening to them, and my kids, all the family, does do that, and we love it. But I'm always happiest when the reader is not too much getting in the way of the author. So in my view, your job is also to establish what kind of tone is this person writing in. Nick Hornby, Jane Austen, you know, Kazuo Ishiguro, or I don't know, Ali Smith. I mean, they've all got very, very different tones, and it's partly your job to find out how does this writer sound, and then serve her or him, and keep yourself a bit out of the way.
You mentioned Jane Austen, and obviously the A.S. Byatt book is another period piece. Do you enjoy historical fiction or period pieces more than any other type of fiction, or do you just get given more of those books than anything else nowadays?
I don't necessarily enjoy them more. I mean, I love reading contemporary fiction, and I'm always delighted to have a brand new book that's hot off the press, because a lot of what I love to do in the theatre and in screen is to speak to now. I mean, that's really what I want to do, is tell stories about how we are now, where are we in our world, our current world, and how do I speak to that, and how do we collectively speak to it? So that's my sort of great passion, I suppose. So I'm very happy to do new books, but it just so happens I have been asked to do a lot of classics. So yeah, I've done all of Jane Austen, twice over at least, for different publishers. I've done a lot of George Eliot, which was fantastic. I've done a lot of Brontes, and quite often you get to the sort of the less known works. I've done almost all of Virginia Woolf. Yes, there's been a lot of that. But I've also done quite a lot of contemporary stuff.
Yes, you did a fantastic Barbara Vine, The Brimstone Wedding, a few years ago, which was a terrific book.
Yeah.
And some Rose Tremaine as well, I see, as well.
Oh, that
library.
Was an amazing, called Trespass. Amazing book. I loved doing that. I was completely riveted. That's one I hadn't finished reading when I started, so it partly kept me on my toes as I was reading. Yeah, I loved her.
And you had us all on the edge of our seats a couple of years ago as you were reading each new chapter of Julian Fellowes' Belgravia on a weekly basis.
Oh, yes. Yes, I did. Yes, that was fun. That was a fun one, because that was obviously set in a period of history. And that's a great challenge, because I don't think people did sound exactly like us. I mean, you don't want to put on silly voices. You don't want to distance the listener from the book. At the same time, I think it's always important to have a sense of how people might have spoken at different periods of history, and not to contemporize everything. So yeah, that was really good fun, that one.
Now, that's the book that you read all by yourself. I noticed that some of the books in the RNIB library you've read with a cast of 2 or 3 other narrators. That seems to be becoming a little bit more common. Is that something that you enjoy doing, or would you prefer to read the entire book yourself?
I'm very happy to do it. It's a bit odd because you don't meet the other reader normally, and they either have already recorded and you're coming in after, or the other way around. And so there's no collective decision about how you're going to read it and what the tone of that author is, as I just talked about. I probably would rather read the whole thing myself because I'm, you know, a bit of a junkie for this and a bit of a workaholic. So I'm so happy to immerse in the whole book. But there are times when a book really requires a male voice and a female voice, or different kinds of voice or whatever. So it's an interesting development. And I think it may be lovely for the reader to have more than one, just me droning on hour after hour, but to have a sense of readers coming and going. But yeah, it's not as satisfying in the end because you haven't read the whole thing.
And of course, the other ensemble cast talking books that we have are some of the radio plays that you've recorded. I'm thinking particularly of The Murder of Roger Ackroyd that you recorded for our 80th anniversary.
Ah, yeah. Now, those are really good fun. Yeah, those are great. But that's a really different experience. That's more like, well, it's just, yeah, it's a radio play. It's a very different experience. But they're really good fun. And I also did not long ago a version of Mary Poppins, a dramatised version of the original book, which is much darker and stranger than the Mary Poppins film, the original film. So, yeah, they can be great fun, but they're not quite as immersive as reading an entire book.
And I can't let you go without mentioning The Very Hungry Caterpillar. That sounds like it was terrific fun to record, and you did that with the poet Roger McGough.
Yes, I did. Well, my kids had all read that endlessly. You know, we've got copies at home which are sort of chewed and spattered with, you know, orange juice and God knows what, the record of their childhoods, and very moth-eaten book, much loved. So, yeah, it was lovely to be asked to do that. I do love reading children's literature. I read to both my kids a lot. And my son I read to until he was about 14, 15, actually. So that takes us through a lot of literature, and yeah, it's a particular pleasure reading for children.
So if I could offer you any book in the library to record, what would be the book that you would push all the other narrators out of the way to get hold of?
Oh, what a great question. Well, I desperately wanted to read the Harry Potter books because I'd read 4 or 5 of them to my daughter at the time, and I got completely immersed, and I had voices for all those characters. I was particularly proud of my Hagrid and my Dobby the elf, and so I was absolutely furious with Stephen Fry when he was chosen to record them. So if they ever wanted to re-record them with a female voice, because it is a female author, then I would like to put myself forward, please, to be thought about. I would adore to do those books.
Well, let's hope that J.K. Rowling is listening to this programme, and I look forward to seeing plenty more of you if you do come back and record those 7 whopping great books. Juliet Stevenson, thank you so much for giving up your lunch hour to be a guest on Read On.
It's a great pleasure.
The past, as we have been told so many times, is a foreign country where things are done differently. This may be true, indeed it patently is true, when it comes to morals or customs, the role of women, aristocratic government, and a million other elements of our daily lives. But there are similarities, too. Ambition, envy, rage, greed, kindness, selflessness, and above all, love, have always been as powerful in motivating choices as they are today. This is a story of people who lived 2 centuries ago. And yet much of what they desired, much of what they resented, and the passions raging in their hearts were only too like the dramas being played out in our own ways, in our own time.
Juliet Stevenson narrating Belgravia by Julian Fellowes, which is TB23163. For a full list of books narrated by Juliet Stevenson, go to the RNIB Library website, rniblibrary.com, or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999.
Thanks to Juliet Stevenson and to Red Sail.
This is an RNIB Talking Book.
Talking Books has two shows per day, one at 7 a.m. and the other at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime.
My name is Jim Broadbent and I'm delighted to be reading the Talking Books.
Enjoy a classic from the RNIB Talking Books Library morning, afternoon or evening.
This is Julia Donaldson and you're listening to Talking Books.
And for younger listeners or the young at heart, Children's Talking Books is on every Saturday at 9, Sunday at 3 or Tuesday at 6 p.m. Books for all ages all through the day, only on RNIB Connect Radio. At the top of today's show, we heard from Lexi Elliott and about her book, How to Kill Your Best Friend. And now it's time to return to Lexi for the books of her life. Lexi, was there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
Well, it's a slightly interesting question to me because I always wanted to write. As soon as I understood that books were written by authors, you know, way back when I was picking up, very elementary books, I wanted to do that. So there wasn't one specific book that made me fall in love with either reading or writing, but I do recall Anne of Green Gables by Ellen Montgomery being one that was just really important in my childhood, because I really identified with Anne with an E. She was a bright, sparky, intellectually curious girl who was also something of a tomboy. And it was the first time, I think, where I'd seen myself in a character, and I felt like it gave me permission to be those things and not to hide any of those aspects of myself. It sort of said, it's okay to be like that, carry on. And that was really instrumental for me.
I've been hearing some surprising things about you and Matthew. I don't suppose you are any more surprised than I am myself, said Marilla. I'm getting over my surprise now. It was too bad there was such a mistake, said Mrs. Rachel sympathetically. Couldn't you have sent her back? I suppose we could, but we decided not to. Matthew took a fancy to her, and I must say I like her myself, although I admit she has her faults. The house seems a different place already. She's a real bright little thing. Marilla said more than she had intended to say when she began, for she read disapproval in Mrs. Rachel's expression. "It's a great responsibility you've taken on yourself," said that lady gloomily. "Especially when you've never had any experience with children. You don't know much about her, or her real disposition, I suppose, and there's no guessing how a child like that will turn out. But I don't want to discourage you, I'm sure, Marilla." "I'm not feeling discouraged," was Marilla's dry response. "When I make my mind up to do a thing, it stays made up. I suppose you'd like to see Anne. I'll call her in." Anne came running in presently, her face sparkling with the delight of her orchard rovings, but abashed at finding herself in the unexpected presence of a stranger, she halted confusedly inside the door. She certainly was an odd-looking little creature in the short, tight, wincey dress she had worn from the asylum, below which her thin legs seemed ungracefully long. Her freckles were more numerous and obtrusive than ever. The wind had ruffled her hatless hair into over-brilliant disorder. It had never looked redder than at that moment.
That's Sarah Mennell reading from Anne of Green Gables by L.M. Montgomery, available from RNIB Talking Books. And is there a book that on a rainy day you go back to again and again to reread?
That would be a book called Grass by Sherry S. Tepper. It was nominated for the Hugo Award when it came out, which I'm thinking would have been around 1990. And it's it falls into the category of sci-fi fantasy. And one of the things I would say about that genre is that obviously you have to get the world building right, but what really draws people in and keeps them coming back to it is the characterization. And Sherry S. Tepper is just wonderful at that. You you see the world she creates, but you care about those people and they are real to you. And it's just really masterful, both in terms of the scope of the imagination and the detail of the people. And yeah, I love it. And I do go back to it time and time again. I probably read it every couple of years, if not every year.
Among the still figures of the hunters, servant women from the nearby village skimmed, seemingly legless under the long white bells of their skirts, hair hidden beneath the complicated folds of their brightly embroidered headdresses, bearing bright trays covered with glasses no larger than thimbles. Close between Emerald and Amethyst, called Emmy and Amy by the family, and the mistresses Bon Damfels by everyone else, Dimity was polished and brushed to a fare-thee-well, immaculately turned out in her hunting garb, and with a headache already from hair drawn back severely to fit beneath the round black cap. The older girls had red lapels on their coats, showing they had ridden long enough to become members of the hunt. Dimity's color was black as the shadows lying at the back of her eyes, shadows her sisters saw well enough but pretended not to notice. One couldn't indulge oneself. One couldn't allow malingering or cowardice in oneself or in members of the family. "Don't worry," drawled Emerald, the best advice she could offer. "You'll get your hunt colors very soon. Just remember what the riding master told you." At the corner of her jaw, a little muscle leapt and leapt again like a shackled frog. Dimity shivered, the shadows writhing, not wanting to say and yet unable to keep from saying, "Emmy, Mummy said I didn't have to." Amethyst laughed, a tiny shiver of unamusement, emotionless as glass. "Well, of course you don't have to, silly. None of us had to. Even Sylvan and Shevlock didn't have to." Sylvan Bon Damfels, hearing his name, turned to look across the first surface at his sisters, his face darkening perceptibly as he saw that Dimity was with the older girls. With a word of excuse to his companions, he turned to come swiftly over the circle of pale gray turf, skirting the scarlet and amber fountain grasses at its center. "What are you doing here?" he demanded, glaring at the girl. "The riding master told Mummy. You're not nearly ready. Not nearly." This was Sylvan, who spoke his mind even when it was unpopular. Some said because it was unpopular, somewhat enjoying the attention this attracted. Though, if challenged, he would have denied it. To Sylvan, truth was truth and all else was black heresy, though on occasion he had the very human difficulty of deciding which was which.
A clip of Grass by Sherry S. Tepper, as read by Dina Perelman. It wasn't easy to find this book on audio, but if you have a hunt, it is available commercially. And finally, is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but something you've read recently you'd like to recommend.
So I would like to recommend Meg Mason's Sorrow and Bliss, which was one of the books shortlisted on the Women's Prize for Fiction list. And I do try and read that shortlist every year, although I never quite get to it before the prize is announced. But this one, Sorrow and Bliss, if you just heard what it was about, you might be scared off, because it's, you know, a marriage and a family life that is falling apart under the specter of some undefined mental illness, which I typically would have thought was really quite a terrifying prospect. And it is so funny and so heartwarming and so touching, and it can make you cry and laugh sometimes in the same page. And, you know, the protagonist she's just so real and engaging and smart and funny and also tragic at times. And I thought it was a real tour de force. It was just incredibly impressive.
At a wedding shortly after our own, I followed Patrick through the dense crowd at the reception to a woman who was standing by herself. He said that instead of looking at her every 5 minutes and feeling sad, I should just go over and compliment her hat. "Even if I don't like it?" He said, "Obviously, Martha, you don't like anything. Come on." The woman had accepted a canapé from a waiter and was putting it in her mouth when she noticed us, realizing in the same instant that it could not be managed in one bite. As we approached, she lowered her chin and tried to shield her effort to get it all the way in, then all the way out, with the empty glass and supply of cocktail napkins in her other hand. Although Patrick drew out his introduction, she responded with something neither of us could make out. Because she looked so embarrassed, I began speaking as though somebody had given me 1 minute on the topic of ladies' hats. The woman gave a series of little nods, and then as soon as she could, asked us where we lived and what we did with ourselves, and, if she was correct in thinking we were married, how long had we been, and how was it we'd come to know each other in the first place. The quantity and velocity of her questions meant to divert attention from the half-eaten thing now sitting on an oily napkin in her upturned palm. While I was answering, she looked furtively past me for somewhere to put it. When I had finished, she said she might have missed my meaning in saying Patrick and I had never actually met. He was always just there. I turned to consider my husband, at that moment trying to fish an invisible object out of his glass with one finger, then looked back at the woman and said, "Patrick's sort of like the sofa that was in your house growing up. Its existence was just a fact. You never wondered where it came from because you can't remember it not being there. Even now, if it's still there, nobody gives it any conscious thought. Although, I suppose," I went on because the woman didn't move to say anything, "if pressed, you would be able to list every single one of its imperfections and the causes thereof."
Sorrow and Bliss by Meg Mason is read by Amelia Fox. That's the version that's available commercially and from RNIB Talking Books. And Lexi, once again, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's it for today's show. I'll be back at the same time next week for more book news, reviews and author interviews. If you're listening to the podcast, please leave a like and a review. If you're listening to us on RNIB Connect Radio, you can find every back episode by searching for Read On, the audiobook show, RNIB. I can be found on Twitter at @talking_books. And Lexi?
You can find me at lexielliott.com, and I'm at lexielliottwrites on Instagram, and for Twitter it's @elliott_lexi.
Goodbye until next week, and remember to read on.